and welcome back to this episode of CoronaCast. I'm Tilly.
And I'm Hannah Harris. I'm a GP in South London and Tilly's my daughter. And we've been making this podcast for a while now. It's about all things coronavirus. We talk about definitions and how the virus affects different people. We answer people's questions. And in this episode, we take a big look at the science.
And we also talk to experts, which is what's going to happen in this episode.
First, my disclaimer, I'm a GP, I'm not an infectious diseases or public health expert. Opinions expressed are my own and not on behalf of an organisation.
We're very excited about our special guest today, who is Professor Beata Kampmann, and she is a specialist in infectious diseases.
Yes, she's a professor of paediatric infectious diseases and immunology, and she's also a practicing paediatrician at a big London teaching hospital.
We're really looking forward to speaking to her today because she specialises in subjects that we have so many questions about in terms of this virus.
Yeah, so we got to ask her lots of our burning questions about children, children with coronavirus, the unusual characteristics of the virus and why it might be that way, and also possible treatments.
We also talk about the vaccine and why that may take such a long time. And we also speak to her about her amazing work in the Gambia.
We really enjoyed making this interview and we hope you enjoy it too. One thing I just wanted to mention at this point is that in the interview, we mentioned the term epidemiology quite a lot, and I just thought we should explain what that means. It's the branch of medicine that's about sort of distribution and incidence of diseases. So it's about how diseases affect different groups of people, more than others, how a disease can be more prevalent in one country than another, for example, reasons why diseases spread and how they spread. And so obviously with coronavirus, the epidemiology of it is quite an important thing. And I just wanted to clear up what that term meant for the purposes of the interview.
As this is a really long interview, we decided it was best to cut to the chase and get on with it. So yeah, we really hope you enjoy it and find it as interesting as we did.
And over to Beata. Our special guest on CoronaCast today is Professor Beata Kampmann. She's a Professor of Paediatric Infection and Immunity at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, as well as Director of the Vaccine Centre there. She also holds a chair in Paediatric Infection and Immunity and in 2010 was appointed Scientific Director for Vaccinology Research at the Medical Research Council Unit for the Gambia. She directs a comprehensive childhood infection and immunity research programme both in the UK and sub-Saharan Africa. I understand she oversees the research work of a team of 200 people across the world. Beata, it is an absolute honour and a privilege to welcome you to the show today. Thank you so much for coming to speak to us.
Good morning, Hannah. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Now, you have knowledge and expertise in so many areas that we'd love to know about in the context of coronavirus and the current pandemic. But I thought perhaps we should start with talking about sort of the reason we were in touch with you in the first place, which is that we've seen this spike in childhood mortality since the outbreak of coronavirus in this country. And that's all-cause mortality, not because of the virus. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure which data you exactly have seen there, because it would be quite quick to see an impact there. But what is absolutely clear that people have been much more reluctant to bring their children to the attention of A&E or GPs, and you must have seen that in your practice yourself, and also for us who work in hospital medicine as well. So I'm a paediatrician in a London hospital as well as a researcher, and we've clearly seen that most of our beds had to be given over to adult corona patients, and our nurses have started looking after adult patients because that's where the need was. And we were quite worried that we were going to get kind of squeezed out a bit, but actually we've had so many fewer admissions, and it started to worry us quite a lot because we were really thinking, you know, it can't be that children are less sick.
Yeah, and it's been quiet across the board as far as I've heard and seen in GP and in hospitals. I hear that paediatrics is all very, very quiet at the moment.
I mean, I guess one thing is, you know, if kids don't go to school, then they don't pass on as many infectious agents to each other. We just have to acknowledge, you know, that school is a wonderful environment, but it's also an environment of intense social mixing. And therefore, you know, if one person has a snotty nose, the chances are someone else will get it. And then their little brother at home will get it. And that sort of seesawing, snowballing around families is what normally happens. And that's how we all build up immunity. It's not a bad thing. But we haven't seen the attendance at the hospital because of that. Or people also decided to take matters into their own hands and look after maybe ailments at home that they otherwise would have gone to the doctor for.
Yeah, what I was actually referring to really was the investigation by Open Democracy that showed this spike in paediatric mortality. And it was thought that this could be down to the stay-at-home message that has been so important to keep this virus under control. But also it means that parents are very worried about taking their children to A&E or the GP in case their children or they contract the virus.
Yeah, totally. And you know, I'm always a bit shocked when I dial into the hospital switchboard number and the first message I get from the switchboard is literally, do not come here. And it's quite off-putting, actually. So if I didn't know I had to go there, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, take matters into my hands and turn up. But, you know, the whole hospital is divided into the green zones and red zones. And the flow of traffic in the hospital is really quite divided because all the routine stuff has primarily stopped.
Yeah.
So there are people around who are literally, you know, not at all exposed to coronavirus, and they are distancing as much as we're distancing ourselves. We can also distance parts of the hospital. So in our hospital, for example, all the outpatient consultations or the patients who have like chronic stuff going on that we need to see on a regular basis, it's in a completely separate building, which is like we call it the green building, and nobody else goes there who's got corona, you know.
Yeah. So that would be very reassuring for parents to hear, wouldn't it? That when they go to hospital, they are, if they don't have symptoms, they're very unlikely to mix with patients who do.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this is like not just because of corona. These are sort of plans that were like designed and sort of laid down during other types of other times when we also had like epidemics, for example, bad flu outbreaks or the SARS epidemic, or, you know, when we had patients potentially or healthcare staff exposed to coming back from Africa, having potentially been exposed to Ebola or so. So this isn't something that the hospital had to reinvent. This is something the hospital had to activate and upgrade to some degree, because obviously corona has given us much more challenges than the previous episodes.
Sure. And so, yeah, hospitals are teed up to deal with this. So what key messages would you want parents to be given in terms of making sure that their children get the appropriate treatment at the appropriate time?
So I think it's really important that people feel empowered and encouraged to phone for help when they are worried about their children's health. And that usually the first point of contact would be the GP. There is 111, of course, and we've made quite some effort also with the Royal College of Paediatrics to get more specific paediatric advice and expertise into the 111 helpline, because it's very adult geared. And for example, that you should only call if you had a fever for 7 days or so, that is a dangerous practice for children. So we want people to and actually, you know, parents have pretty good instincts, and you're a parent yourself. It's kind of, you know, when your child is not right. You should then seek attention, and if you don't get anywhere, you take your kid to the A&E department.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, I think there's no better advocates for children's health than the advocacy of their parents.
Parents
and
I would really
encourage people to, if they're unsure, if their children have a persistent fever, if they are not eating and drinking, if they have headaches, if they have abdominal pain, if they look, you know, sort of cold and their hands and feet are cold, and then you need to take them.
Yeah. And that's the message we've been trying to relay on the podcast as well, that, you know, GPs are totally open for business. We're mostly doing telephone consultations initially, but seeing people if we think they need to be seen, and also video consultations have proved really, really useful, because we can actually, as we say in medicine, eyeball the child and
How
they look.
I'm a big fan of that. And you know, I don't do too much of it, but I do it for friends, for example, when, you know, someone says, oh, what do you think about this? And I say, can you put them on Skype? You know, because you do get quite some good impression, much better than just describing the symptoms. I mean, you use a very much more sophisticated system that is very much more secure in the GP sector and NHS system. But I think you get even, you know, someone on FaceTime or so, you get some idea about what that child actually looks like and yeah. whether you need to immediately worry or immediately unworry. And that's really important.
Yeah. yeah. And the other key thing about children, I suppose, which is important in talking about them becoming seriously ill, is that we always see in pediatrics that children compensate for so long and so well when they're really ill. And that's another reason why your message about going to the doctor as soon as you're worried is important, because children can look fine for ages and then suddenly get really, really sick.
Sure. Luckily, that is the exception rather than the rule. And I think people have a common sense of distinguishing a child with, you know, a cold and a cough from someone who's really pretty unwell.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. So just on one small thing in the context of the coronavirus thing, we've seen some children recently who either had corona a little while ago or have been in contact with people, although their corona might be negative, who got very unwell. Mm-hmm. Now, this was circulated to the GPs, for example, and there was quite a lot of alarm. And I think it's right to be alarmed, but also to put it in perspective with the thousands of children who've remained absolutely well. But again, you know, if GPs are seeing children with, you know, abdominal pain, prolonged fever, who are looking as if they've got, you know, sort of toxic looking, you know, then please send them in.
Yeah, and this is, I've done a little bit of reading about that. There isn't that much information available, sort of specific information, but it's quite young children, isn't it, who can be affected, and that it's this.
Yeah, not only, you know, we also had a 13-year-old, we had a 7-year-old, so this isn't just the little ones, and we're, at the moment, you know, this is all quite new to us.
Yeah,
and we're trying to we've just made up some guidelines together with our colleagues in the country. We've also reached out to colleagues internationally, and the guidelines are there now from the British Paediatric Infection and Immunity Group, and they're primarily for our colleagues in hospital. So I don't want to sound too alarmist about it, but it is not true that coronavirus is like just a bit of a cough for small children. There are some children who have some serious issues and we need to look out for them.
Yeah, so we are certainly on the lookout for that now in general practice. Another phenomenon I don't know if you've seen in hospital is in young people is this concept of COVID toes.
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah, I had a patient with that and no other symptoms, and then I heard that it was actually I said, oh, your trainers are probably rubbing when you go running, but then I heard that it's actually a symptom.
Absolutely. It looks like chilblains.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not exactly what we see a lot in the UK. But, you know, we've seen some weird sort of rashes and skin manifestations of COVID. And we think that the inflammation in the body leads to sort of little vasculitic lesions, which means that the little blood vessels can get a bit inflamed. And you can see that in lesions and the feet, like, yeah, rightly, as you say. So you've seen it in general practice, right? It looks just like chilblains.
Mm. Yeah, it really
There's
does.
There's a poster that has various manifestations of rashes from corona going around. So there's about 6 or 7 different ways that children have been seen with these rashes.
Oh, okay. I'll look out for that. We could post it on our podcast description.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And just moving on then, so, like, you know, obviously some children do get very unwell, but they are very much in the minority with coronavirus. And what do you have any idea, coming on to your sort of immunological expertise, why do children tend to only get the virus mildly? Do we know that yet?
This is a really important question, and it's one from which we could learn so much, because if there is something special about children, then maybe that's the sort of thing we need to look for when we're making vaccines or drugs to combat the disease. So at the moment, we're not quite sure about that. So one of my theories is that because children have very frequent colds and coughs especially in young age, when they grow up and build up their immune system, a number of these are caused by coronaviruses, by other coronaviruses. And there are 4 coronaviruses that are just causing like colds and coughs. And, you know, if you swab children's noses, for example, that's one thing we do in our research studies to see what actually they're carrying. About 14% of them have a coronavirus. And it might just be that having been exposed to a coronavirus recently, gives you some bits of what we would call cross protection or cross immunity from the antibody that you have that is induced by the coronavirus that is not this horrible coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, and that there is a degree of cross protection. The other thing that is being ventilated around is because the immune system of the children is a bit different from the immune system of older people. The regulation is a bit different. We don't see so much in pregnant women either, which is interesting, because usually with infectious diseases, young children and pregnant women are very susceptible also to severe disease.
Yeah, so this is unusual.
Yeah, it is unusual. And we believe that the way that the cells interact in the system in very young children is a bit different. We know that from our studies. And it could be that prevents children from getting, you know, this what's called cytokine storm kind of manifestation and severe lung disease. Mm. And the third issue is there's this particular receptor that the virus latches onto in the blood, which is called the ACE2 receptor.
Yeah, and that's, I've heard a lot about that.
And you know that from GP as well, of treating adults with hypertension with anti-ACE2 inhibitors and things.
Yeah.
So it's a receptor that sits on cells in the body, and where the coronavirus, like, it's a sort of lock and key mechanism. And depending on how many of these receptors you might have on your system, the more you might be locking the virus in. Mm-hmm. And there is a soluble form, which is like shedded, and one that's sitting on the cells. And the percentages of the shedded to what sits on cells is different in children from older adults. And it might be that there's just not as many, you know, if you want to describe them as the locks, not as many locks going around in the children onto which the virus can latch on.
Yeah, interesting. That would certainly seem a scientific, rational explanation for why that happens.
What we really need to do is swab a lot of people's noses, including a lot of children's noses. So, Tilly, how do you feel about having your nose swabbed?
I don't mind. If it helps me get out of the house again, I'll have my nose swabbed.
Yeah, I know, anything, right, yeah. You know, in some diseases like flu, we know that children are massive spreaders. And we know that, you know, we need to give elderly the vaccine and children so that we stop flu going around the winter, for example. With corona, we haven't quite got that because the children are less ill, less of them come to hospital, lots of them are asymptomatic. We don't know how much virus is really going around in their noses, whether they have a lower viral load or whether they have mechanisms in their noses that protect them from getting, you know, a higher virus inoculated. We don't know. And we could only really do that by swabbing people regularly, periodically in households, like almost like once a week. You would have to, you know, get all your entire family swabbed and then wait for the ones that are going to get the disease and then see how that propagates around the household. So that's the sort of design which would let you get to the crux of that. And some of those studies are currently going on.
Now, are there any, would you say there are any preventative measures that people could take in order to protect themselves against the virus? Do you have any sense of that? Yet.
Yeah, you know, I can't really give any other advice than what we're given with public health. And you know, the mask discussion is interesting, but I really don't know if that will make a massive difference. In my view, you know, the social distancing is the way to bring down the famous R, the wear replication number, in which, because if we don't interact, then we don't pass on. That's as easy as that. But, you know, that's not a sustainable situation for the long-term future. And we just need to be very careful monitoring that R. People are starting, I see a lot more people with masks than I saw a couple of weeks ago. And initially we were quite adamant saying, well, masks are useless. But the jury is really switching a little bit here, and it's almost like going to the point where people say, well, if it doesn't do harm, why not do it, even if we know that it might not make a big difference? And we're primarily, you know, there's a great, and Tilly, you might have seen it, there's a great YouTube video out there. There's a young woman explaining, and it ends up with saying, well, if you wear a mask, you protect me. If I wear a mask, I protect you. And if we all wear a mask, we're all protecting each other. You know, it's really nicely explained. I don't know if you've seen that one.
No, I haven't.
No, we'll have a look out for it.
I think it's from Spain to start with. I think people are taking matters into their own hands. I mean, what is really important is that people realise that these things are not 100%, and they mustn't stop washing their hands just because they're wearing a mask, and they also mustn't stop keeping distances in shops and things.
Yeah, because I think as people begin to kind of follow the measures like social distancing and wearing masks, as it like kind of lessens the spread, then it can feel quite far away for a lot of people. I think definitely that's what I've seen and kind of what I felt too, like no one around me really has been badly affected. It can feel quite far away, but that's because of what we're doing and we need to keep doing it.
Well, that's right. It's almost like you then, it's victim of your own success kind of story. Yeah. You know, if you go to the hospital just for a couple of days, you realize very quickly that this is not at all the case. Mm. But, you know, I live in a neighborhood here where, you know, I haven't seen anyone fall seriously ill, thank God. And we have all these neighborhood initiatives and stuff to keep each other healthy in this time. And you can almost think, okay, well, let's just have the street party with a mask. Well, that's definitely not what we want to do right now.
No, masks are certainly not 100% protective. Although we do have to balance this out with the loneliness that we're seeing.
I know.
Some people.
There's some really fancy designs though with the masks.
Yeah, I think they're going to become creativity. Fashion.
I think so too. You know, you can just about see it taking off.
Yeah, London 100%. Fashion Week next year. and then if we could just come on to, well, back to how the virus manifests itself a little bit. We talked in our last episode, our one before, with Dr. Kelly from A&E, about the Black, Asian and minority ethnic disproportion in terms of severity of the disease. And I wondered if you have any idea about that in terms of why that happens from a scientific point of view.
Yeah, so the first thing to always ask is what is the denominator? Because we've got an overall proportion of people working from Black and ethnic minorities working in the healthcare sector and in the care sector is much higher than the proportion of the same ethnic groups in the society at large. So that's the first thing to sort of epidemiologically to delineate, you know, are we seeing many more people from Black and ethnic minorities amongst the dead people, amongst all of those who also have succumbed, who are not from those ethnic groups as healthcare professionals? And I think the answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. Then the next question is it because people have been in positions where they felt less empowered for asking for PPE, for example? And this is quite political. And I think you will probably see that there are people there who have given enormous service to, you know, care homes, etc., and they've been disproportionately affected. And when I hear the stories from family members that their mothers and fathers were coming home saying, you know, I really need this, but I can't get it, or they told me if I don't turn up, I lose my job, I can see that there is a disempowerment of that community that might have made them more vulnerable to get severe disease and succumb.
Yeah,
there is, of course, the question, is there something, you know, innately more susceptible for particular ethnic groups? I don't think we can say that at the moment, but people are obviously looking at that in the science as well and see if their immune system reacts in a different way, or, you know, it's too early to really conclude, or whether there's particular genetic susceptibility, for example, the ACE receptor. We're learning so much, you know, this virus is only 4 months old and we've already learned that, you know, there are so many different regulatory mechanisms in our bodies. So I think it's a little early to come to any conclusions about that. But clearly, we're looking at it, and it's important that the population feels that we're looking at it for everyone and not just for, you know, one particular part of society, and they then might feel ostracized by it, right? So this is a real genuine, scientific endeavor to try and figure out what is different between groups of people. And this can be very easily hijacked very quickly into, oh, well, there's a picking on this group, or there is stigmatization, etc. And I would be really sad if it was interpreted like that. You know, our bodies are differently regulated. The bodies of children are different from adults. The bodies of young people are different from old people. The bodies of people, if you've grown up in Africa, might be different from the exposure of people that we've had in the UK and in North America, etc. And the level of comorbidities in so associated other diseases in particular ethnic groups are also different. So I think we need to acknowledge that and not bring a whole bunch of baggage to it at this point, and just try try and stay objective and say, hey, you know, there seems to be a predominance. Is it an epidemiological factor, or is it also a medical, a genetic, an exposure issue?
Yeah, we need to be perfectly willing to acknowledge the difference and explore it. And just about the nature of the virus again itself. So I was reading, and please excuse my ignorance, but I read somewhere that the structure of the virus is like the SARS virus, but with an added HIV protein. Is that true?
You know, I'm not a virologist myself, but I'm not aware of that. So the SARS virus is also from the coronavirus family. Mm-hmm. So they, altogether, there's seven coronaviruses that we know of. So four are part of the common cold, and they've just been around us for ages and ever. And then there's SARS, which was the coronavirus that caused all the diseases in 2003 and around that time. Mm-hmm. And then there's MERS, which is the virus that came from the Middle East and affects camels as well, for example. And then now there is SARS-CoV-2. So it's like the SARS virus with coronavirus, given the nomenclature type 2, as opposed to the other one, which was SARS-1. So I'm not aware, and there might be some confusion, because we have trialed some anti-HIV drugs for, you know, giving to folks with SARS-CoV-2. And they've had, they interfere with the replication enzyme, the protease that is partially part of the engine that replicates the virus in our cells. And maybe that enzyme must be there, because other that drug would have had no, there would have been no rationale. So, but the viruses are very, very distinct from each other.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thanks for that clarification. And yeah, it looks like remdesivir, one of the antiretrovirals that treats HIV so far, is looking like possibly a possible treatment.
So just to clarify, remdesivir isn't an antiretroviral.
Oh, okay.
Remdesivir is an antiviral. Antiretroviral means it's particularly for retroviruses, of which HIV is one. So with, I think that's where the confusion arises a little bit. And lopinavir was a drug that is used in antiretroviral therapy for people with HIV, and that was trialed with SARS-CoV-2, and it hasn't been found to be effective. So let's put that to one side.
Okay, so no,
and then we can talk about, it's called an antiviral, like acyclovir is an antiviral as well, against herpes viruses. So remdesivir was developed during the time of the Ebola outbreak, and it didn't show much antiviral effectiveness against Ebola, but it has shown so from the data we've seen, and these are not yet peer-reviewed and properly published, you know, in a large data set, we've seen that the people who were treated with remdesivir in this study in the US had a 30% reduction in the time that they spent in hospital. So instead of being there for 15 days, which was the average of the people who got the placebo, or I don't even know if it was placebo control, but the ones who got remdesivir stayed for 11 days. It didn't have an impact on the death rates, for example. And I think that's really important to remember. So it might shorten the stay in hospital, but this is by no means the magic bullet.
The magic cure.
And it's it's also an infusion that you have to give for 10 days on, you know, an infusion every day. So it's not the sort of treatment that you could, for example, easily do in the community.
Yeah, quite an invasive treatment.
Yeah, and what might be the case is that because these treatment trials were done with people who were already quite sick, as always, when we don't quite know, we start off with, you know, the worst manifestations, and then we kind of look at, if we gave it earlier, would it be better? And there are now some trials going on where it is also given a bit earlier, but it's still not a community drug. And, you know, we still need much better than a 30% reduction of stay in hospital.
Yeah.
And we need larger groups. And actually, there is a big initiative in the UK where every single patient is literally enrolled in a randomized trial. So you get treatment, but you don't necessarily get this particular treatment. You might get another treatment. And then as we go along with big numbers, we'll be able to tell whether what anything has made a difference. And hopefully it does. And I really believe that this is the way we should be using these drugs, because we don't yet have, you know, if there was an agreed treatment that was definitely effective, then everybody should have it. But at a time where it's what we call equipoise, where we don't really know which one might work and which one might not work, you would just give, you know, in one arm gets this, a bit like we've always done with childhood leukemia, for example. Children go into various arms of various regimens, and then after a little while we found out which is the absolute optimal one, and that's what brought down the survival rates of childhood leukemia to over 85%. So we need to be amazing. You know, we need to be good with ourselves and follow that.
Yeah, and it's so tempting, I guess, when you've got all of these unwell people in front of you to just try anything, but it's really important that we don't do that.
No, that's right. And you know, you and I will operate on do no harm principles. Yeah. And some of these treatments, like hydroxychloroquine, it all looked good and shares went up and everybody wanted to, you know, all of a sudden stockpile the hydroxychloroquine. And, you know, it's actually turned out to have quite some nasty side effects. And you know, the bottom's fallen out of that at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Things are changing all the time, aren't they? Like you say, we're only 4 months in and we know so little and we're learning more all the time.
Oh, all the time, yeah.
Yeah. The symptomatology with this virus is so unusual. That's what I've been really noticing in general practice, the fact that people can have it asymptomatically for a long time. They have this concept of pre-symptomatic infectiousness. The incubation's long. The symptoms are so varied among different people and the severity. Is this particularly unusual for a virus, or is this...
I mean, you've probably seen much more of the spectrum than I've seen it, because I've primarily been hospital based and we really see the people who were sick enough to come to the hospital. Mm. So you've got a really good overview there. So I think it is unusual. Because, you know, this, for example, these symptoms with the fact that people can't smell. It's not something that is very frequent, and the fact that people get funny blue toes at 1 minute and then it goes away, you know.
Yeah, so we never see that.
No, I think it is unusual. It just shows, because, you know, thinking about flu, I mean, you know, it's not the same type of virus, but just thinking about it, you know, people usually get fever and the myalgia, like sore muscles, need to lie in bed a bit, the joints feel sore, and then they sometimes get a cough. It's quite a well-described sort of spectrum of, you know, maybe 5-6 things. With corona, we've seen all sorts of stuff. And if you think about SARS, for example, which is also from the coronavirus family, as I've just said, it was very much the pneumonia that brought people into hospital. Mm-hmm. And it was much more what we call a lower respiratory tract infection. And that is, it was very organ specific. And what we're seeing with corona is that people also go into sort of this multi-organ failure.
Yeah, systems.
Exactly. And we have a lot of people on dialysis machines, to the point where, you know, several places run out of the fluid. So they had to be very careful to make sure that they circulated the dialysis machines and the fluids, shared it equitably between the people in the intensive care unit. So I know that's been an issue. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is quite unusual. And I don't know whether we'll get to, you know, putting all the data together, people will be able to say, okay, well, this is common in whatever 20%, or every week you get a new summary of all the cases have been seen with various tables telling you so many people at this, so many people at that. So I think it is unusual. And if you ask me why, I don't know.
Yeah, and who knows? Perhaps that's something that will come out in the next months and years. Who knows?
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to your area of specialism, vaccination. Obviously, there is this huge push at the moment to find a vaccine for this virus. And it just so happens that we're just coming to the end of World Immunization Week, aren't we? And you've been talking about immunizations all week for that in some events.
Yeah, thanks for following that. Yes, it was World Immunization Week. It's always the last week in April. And it's really there to draw attention to all the amazing things that have been achieved in terms of human health through vaccines. And we had a whole series of webinars in my vaccine center every day. We were talking about a different vaccine that was given to a different age group, because the theme was vaccines are for life. And now with the coronavirus vaccine, everybody, of course, is anxious to see when that vaccine is going to emerge. Yes.
Yeah. And I've listened to a couple of the talks. They were absolutely fascinating. I really enjoyed them. I listened to most of the one that you did yesterday about the coronavirus vaccine. And I found that particularly interesting, obviously. And yes, sure. But well, because what I had really sort of failed to understand, and what sort of the non-medic in me came out a bit, and I was like, why does it take so long to find a vaccine? Surely you can just develop it, give it to some people, figure out that it works, roll it out, you know. But, you know, watching that talk had made me understand more about this huge process that has to take place in the development of a vaccine. I think in one of the talks it said it took 15 years to develop the HPV vaccine and 20 years to develop the another malaria vaccine.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit about this process and why it takes so long?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, you know, there are two things we need a vaccine to do. We need it to protect against the disease that we have in our minds, but we also need it to be safe. There's no point in having a vaccine with you then in bed for days and days after you've had the vaccine. The first thing that people would say is, I'm not having it. And the second thing is, if you have a safe vaccine, but it doesn't do anything, you might as well drink a glass of water, right? So both of those things need to come together. And to move from an idea of, you know, the first thing is you have to have obviously a target disease, like with corona is an excellent example. It was there immediately. Then you need to know what in the immune system would have to be stimulated to recognize that intruder and make the kind of immune response that you think is important to fight it off. So that is called antigen discovery. So the antigen in this case is the coronavirus. It's not the whole virus, it's particular bits on the virus. For example, the spike protein that we've been hearing so much about, the bits that stick out from the virus that we know the immune system will see, and that will initiate the immune response. So as soon as the virus sequence was available, and that was done very quickly in China, that sequence was used in the lab to generate proteins and antigens that could be used to make the vaccine. And, you know, you probably have seen on this, we've got this tracker on our website at the London School as well. There are now over 100 products which are literally just the sort of ingredients, and that's called the preclinical phase. And in the preclinical phase, you need to think about the ingredients, and you also need to think about how you're actually going to pack up these ingredients. For example, there are some vaccines now that are working on the principle of being DNA or RNA. So there the idea is you give just the genomic information to the body, and the body then makes its antibody by being stimulated to replicate that information. And then that kind of generates the antigen itself, and the body will make antibody. But you have to, you know, you can't just inject a bit of RNA somewhere. You have to package that up in some sort of adjuvant that helps you to deliver the piece of antigen to the bit where you want it to be seen. Sure. That's the same with the other type. Exactly. So that could be, That could be a liposome, which is like a fat bubble. It could be some sort of adjuvant that have been used in other vaccines, but it all needs to be put together. So there's a hell of a lot of chemical stuff involved in that. Or, for example, the vaccine that is currently in clinical trials in Europe, which is the vaccine from Oxford, which has been discussed a lot. So they use a viral vector, so another virus, to bring the antigen, which is the, again, a protein from which is not harmful, which is wrapped up, literally fused together with this non-replicating virus, which is harmless to people. And then that's injected. So, like, you know, turning on the machine of replication by giving another virus, then expressing the antigen to show it to the immune system. So the immune system kicks in and makes the antibody or whatever defense we think is important. So that's already a complicated process, which is in the preclinical phase. Yeah. Then you need to give that to some animals, because you can't really stick stuff. Well, this is a bit controversial, but you shouldn't really be sticking stuff into people until you've had some safety data from animals. So one of the vaccine trials that went ahead in the US has actually done these things in parallel, which was quite unprecedented, but so far so good. Let's keep our fingers crossed. But ideally, in the normal vaccine development process, you'll do some animal experiments, because you also need to see that what you put in there is giving you the immune response that you're hoping for. So then you're at the point where you say, okay, that's all looking cool. So let's try it for safety in a group of people who are very unlikely to have side effects. So we're talking people like Tilly, you know, you would be eligible to enter into study, probably your mum as well. So you take healthy adults between the ages of, let's say, 18, because they need to be able to consent for themselves, mm-hmm. and 50, 55, that sort of group. And you give the vaccine to a small group of those. It's usually up to like maybe 100 or so. And you want to see if there's anything, you know, if there's it's safe to do so. And these people will be very carefully assessed before they even go into the study. They will have blood tests. They need to be free of all infections. They must be immunocompetent. So they have a whole MOT, really. Mm-hmm. And then the ones that are selected will get the injection. And in the case of the Oxford trial, they also get, half of them get the vaccine against corona and the other half get another vaccine, because sometimes you need to give rather than giving a placebo, which is like a saline injection, mm-hmm. you want to give something that's also potentially of benefit for them, or something that also induces, you know, mild symptoms like you might be getting with the coronavirus vaccine. Mm-hmm. So there you're looking out for local responses, which means do you get a very sore arm? I mean, you've all had vaccines, you know what it can feel like. Yeah. You know, it's a quick injection, it's all fine. And then the next day, like the flu vaccine, for example, you feel your arm is a bit heavy.
It really hurts, yeah.
Yeah, but it does go away normally. Yeah, it doesn't last much longer than a day or two. Or, you know, if you get a more severe side effect, you might get a fever. But if the fever lasts for days, then already you're having a bit of a safety signal. So you don't really want to have that. So let's say that's all fine and good. Then the next phase is where you will be taking blood from people as they go along as volunteers as well. And depending on the size of the group that you've chosen for your safety study, you can already tell a bit about what the vaccine is doing to their immune system. So in phase two, then you extend that group of volunteers to a larger number. And you might also start including people who are not, you know, the same sort of pristine 18 to 55 year olds. But for example, in the Oxford trial, they'll be extending also to children and to older people, because ultimately we want a vaccine that works in all age groups. And particularly it's interesting to figure out whether it will work for the elderly, because, you know, that might be a target group right up front, because we're currently locking people away in their 70s and 80s and they're really suffering from the isolation, yeah, because they might not be on, you know, yeah, the Netflix party room or whatever, you know, it's the ways of interacting might be more restricted. But let's say, so that's then the phase two, and there you get a lot more information about what happens in the immune system of people who've had the vaccine and whether that corresponds to what you expect to happen. And if the phase two is big enough, you already get a glimpse whether that might be protecting against the infection. So for example, in the Oxford trial, I think they're going to have up to 5,000 people who would have received the vaccine in the phase two. And they would, you know, in the situation where we're still exposed to the virus, there might already be a way that you can tell whether the people who had the vaccine are less likely to get corona compared to the ones who didn't have the vaccine. But that's no guarantee, because there might not be enough virus going around to really prove the pudding. Mm. And the proof of the pudding is the phase three, which is the efficacy trials, where you give the vaccine to large numbers of people, tens of thousands usually, and then you study the end point of that is, are you getting the disease or are you not getting the disease? Yeah. And that whole, you know, the whole process can take years and years, but it won't take years and years with corona, because we're already in phase two with one vaccine, we're in phase one with another three, so, and then there's another four trials which are imminently starting, and they, you know, it will get a lot quicker. And also, yeah, really, you know, what's happened with the vaccine research is that sometimes people had to apply bit by bit by bit for the funding, yeah, to go from one phase, and people would only believe you if you'd already shown the result from one phase going to the other, etc. So I'm rambling on, but just to show you that it takes quite some time. And I think we'll be quicker. This time the funding is on the table, and the people who have to agree that the vaccine can be, you know, licensed and put on the market are already working with the researchers and industry to see what does it need to, which promises need to be fulfilled for the vaccine to be both safe and effective and be licensed? And that's all happening parallel, and that's unprecedented. But we learned a lot from Ebola about that process.
Incredible. So, yeah, so this process that can be very, very long and drawn out is actually where they can sort of take shortcuts. They're taking them and overlapping the processes a little bit. Which...
That's right. And it's important that safety is not considered as a shortcut, because we do need to have the vaccine safe. Because imagine, let's say the vaccine fails, it's not just the vaccine or one of the candidates that is heading ahead now fails. It's potentially destroying their credibility of, first of all, making coronavirus vaccine, and secondly, it reflects badly on all sorts of other vaccines we might be having, and people might decide, well, they're not having vaccines, right? You know, the whole vaccine hesitancy issues.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We really do not want to see that happening, because vaccines are needed for corona and for all the other infectious diseases that we can fortunately prevent with them.
Yeah, so that's yet another reason why doing it all properly and safely is so, so important.
Yeah.
I wonder what will happen beyond all of this in terms of people's willingness for their children to have vaccinations. We've seen the, you know, terrible effects of a virus that's out of control where we don't have a vaccination. And I wonder if people are going to be more willing to have their children vaccinated now.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so, because, you know, the fact that we have a vaccine against a virus that is about seven times more infectious than corona, which is measles, and people deciding they're not taking that vaccine, is maybe people will think again, because they have all of a sudden seen what happens when large parts of population can get affected. And what we hope as well is, by talking so much about the process and about the mechanisms that are put in place and stuff, that people understand a little bit more what is actually invested in this vaccine development. It's not just something that, you know, falls off the shelf on Monday, it gets given to people on Friday, and that is really a thoughtful process with belts and braces.
Yeah, loads of checking all the way through.
Really important to get right as well.
Okay, and I just wanted to touch on, Beata, your work that you do in Africa, in the Gambia, and just hear a bit more about that. Because, well, at the moment, in terms of coronavirus, we're not hearing very much from Africa. And I understand the numbers appear to be relatively low, although I don't know whether that's just due to poor levels of reporting. But it would just be interesting to hear more about your views on that, and also about your work that you do there.
Sure. So I work at the MRC unit in the Gambia, which is also now part of the London School. It's a research institution that's been there for 70 years and has been absolutely instrumental in bringing vaccines through EPI programs, but also in, you know, elimination of malaria research, in overall pneumonia research, etc. There's a huge long history. Nutrition, very important part as well. Mm-hmm. So obviously, when corona hit, the first thing we were thinking of was, oh my gosh, what is this going to look like in the setting in resource-poor countries such as the Gambia? For example, there's not a single ventilator in the Gambia. The Gambia is a small country. It's got 2 million, just over 2 million population, and it doesn't really have functional intensive care. And what that is, you know, largely the case for many of these settings that we're thinking and talking about, or some hospitals might have some intensive care facilities, but there's no way that the resource poor settings can upscale in the way we've done for the NHS, or people have done in Italy and Germany and many other places. So there's just no way. So the question is, what are the services that we can offer that might make a difference? Mm. And, you know, the first thing we were looking at was our capability to actually give people oxygen. Because if you come in with a bad pneumonia, that's the first thing you will need. And our capabilities were quite limited. So we bought oxygen concentrators and set up a ward specifically for corona patients as they might come through. We also had to think through the protection of our staff. We employ over 1,000 people, and their health of the staff and also the people who are involved in our studies is the first priority. But we're also working very closely with the government to make sure that we're helping them to prepare the country. And for example, we took on the testing for coronavirus in our molecular laboratories, because the facilities weren't there in the public health labs. And we've now trained people from the public health labs to transition that to their facilities. So you know, lower resource settings, they're not all the same. For example, in Senegal, they have very good laboratory facilities and they could do their testing even before we did ours. And they have a better infrastructure for their healthcare system. But and South Africa has taken very, you know, drastic steps very early, and they seem to have managed to contain a great deal. Although I was very worried because I've also lived and worked in South Africa, and the housing conditions of a population are not always ideal. And you thinking about people being given all this great advice about self-isolating is very difficult if you live with 10 people in a shack. So, yeah, you know, it's really, just really totally there, lockdown. It's been really, really difficult. And the economical consequence for people not being able to go to work, not being able to buy food. You know, you've seen the bun fights about food in Kenya. There was a feature on the news last night. So the socioeconomic impact of even the lockdown or the social distancing in the low resource settings is even worse than it is in our settings. I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars that are, you know, are falling out of the economy in high income settings. It's not even measurable what's going on in low income settings. And other services, for example, antenatal clinics and vaccine clinics and health services in general, are already deeply affected even by the fact that people are told to stay at home. So obviously, you know, what you're going to do, you're still going to go to your antenatal appointment, or you're going to just wait till the day of delivery and then decide to either have your baby at home or maybe go to the clinic. So these are really, really hard choices for people. And, you know, the risk-benefit ratios need to be very, very carefully considered. And it's, if, I mean, so far, Africa hasn't been majorly hit by the epidemic, and whether it is because people haven't traveled there, mainly the diseases, the virus was brought in, obviously, through traveling, or it's not taken hold because of temperature differences, or maybe because the immune response has been different, or maybe the quarantining has worked quite well. These, again, are all things that are going to evolve. And I'm sure in the next couple of months, we will see if this is going to become a massive hit for Africa or not. And it might be different in different settings. But, you know, there is no question that the resources available to fight this virus in Africa, or also in India or other low income settings or middle income settings. You've seen reports from Brazil, right? So, I mean, Brazil Brazil is a very interesting country because it has extreme wealth, but it also has extreme poverty. And, you know, seeing this feature where they were digging mass graves, you know, it just, this is just a thing to worry about the effects that would be very similar in Africa. And Ebola has shown us what happens to healthcare systems that are already weak when something else comes along and literally swamps all the facilities and all the personnel that is available. So I'm really worried about that.
And also, I suppose that takes us on to the fact that the vaccine will be so important in African countries. And we need to make sure that they have access to the vaccine, because obviously there'll be an inclination for the wealthy countries to, well, to have easier access to it.
So the equity issue around the vaccine access is really important, and that's why WHO and CEPI are also very much partners in negotiating the processes under which the vaccines are made available and licensed. And you know, I would be very surprised if there wasn't a major bun fight.
I mean, lives are on the line.
But this is also why it's so important that we keep on vaccinating people, especially in the vulnerable populations, against conditions like measles, etc., which would spread like wildfire in impoverished communities if we didn't have the vaccine, and then corona or whatever other thing would come on top of it. So we need to make every effort for that to be sustained.
Yeah, it throws into relief what how important vaccines are and their value in every country, in all corners of society. Well, that was so illuminating and brilliant. Thank you so much for talking to us, Beata.
It's a pleasure. I hope I've given you a few pointers. And, you know, I think we all have to admit that we are at the beginning of understanding what really, you know, not only the epidemiological impact and the economic consequences, but a lot to be learned around the clinical signs, symptoms, the management, also what drives severe disease in some people and not in others, and it's a very rich picking. But, you know, also remember that there are still other diseases around, and not to completely lose sight of people who might be needing cancer diagnostics, who might be needing vaccines, etc. A lot is asked of us right now as a society, and that's in the point of a pandemic, that's just going to be an issue in every country.
Yeah, and that comes back to our first key message about, you know, urging people, if they're unwell, children and adults, to go and get medical help, because
absolutely
other illnesses are still very much out there.
Yeah, we're still here.
Yeah, we certainly are, open for business. Yeah. Tilly, did you have anything else you wanted to ask Beata?
I guess just to kind of leave it on some sort of a positive, how do you feel about the virus? Like, do you feel that there's hope and light at the end of the tunnel?
There's definitely hope and light at the end of the tunnel. I have a really limited vision of the tunnel, unfortunately, because, you know, the tunnel doesn't seem to be just a straight tunnel. It will come in some turns, you know. And I think we just have to live with the fact that the virus isn't just going to go away, but that we have to adjust. And this whole thing about, you know, second spikes and things, I think we're going to have a lot of ripples. But if you maybe think about, you know, that beautiful image when you flick the stone across the water.
Yeah.
The first ripple is the biggest. And then as it jumps on, and it will jump on, the ripples get smaller.
Yeah.
And I think that's how I see it.
Oh, that's
and maybe that's an image you can take away.
Yeah, I really like that. Yeah, keep some hope there.
Yeah.
Because it is difficult.
But, you know, we all have a role to play. So we can all, that's the thing. It's not just something that's happened to us. It happens with us.
Thank you. And on that note, we will say goodbye, Beata. Thank you so much. Have a lovely weekend.
You too.
I'm sure it's difficult for you to be taking any time out because you've got so much going on and you're so busy with work.
It's sunny today, so I'll be able to go for a run, which is great.
Brilliant. Okay, yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And good luck with all your work.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Beata for that amazing interview. It was so insightful. Me personally, I found it so interesting to hear about vaccines. I mean, of course, in lockdown, people are very impatient and want that vaccine out as quickly as possible. But I think it's really useful to understand why it takes such a long time. If we need it to be a safe thing for us to have, we need it. It's going to have to take a while.
Yeah, and I think it actually showed how we can appreciate how much the process is being sped up in this situation.
And applaud the people that are putting that much work in to get something so big done so quickly.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And we would also want to pick up on the point we were all making about how people need to seek medical help for their children sooner rather than later. If their children fall ill, don't hesitate to contact your GP or 111 or A&E if your child is unwell.
Yeah, that still stands with children and with anyone. I feel like we can't hammer that point home enough.
No, exactly. We've mentioned it a number of times on the podcast now, and I think we will probably be continuing to do so.
Yeah.
And the other thing she said about at the end about the stone skipping across the water.
Yeah, this is a big thing, and I think it will be prevalent in our lives for a long time and potentially present in our lives forever, but we will get through it.
Yeah, it was a really beautiful image that she talked about there. And yeah, we look forward to watching this particular stone skip across the water away from us.
Far away.
And now on to our positive news for the episode.
Yep. So my positive news. Well, we've had a week with TV, haven't we, Mum?
We really have.
We actually did mention this last episode, but I'm going to mention it again because it's worth mentioning a million times. It is a series, Normal People, on BBC Three, on iPlayer. We watched it. I mean, it's been raved about everywhere. I'm sure most of our listeners, if not all, have heard of it by now.
Everybody's talking about
it. Yeah, because it is honestly my favourite series of all time.
It's absolutely brilliant. The acting, the script, the music,
the way it's shot. Like, I just can't fault it. I'm currently rewatching it. I'm listening to the playlist, the soundtrack. of the series.
There's also a podcast.
Yep, which I need to get on. I didn't know that until today. I highly recommend it to everyone. It's just such a beautiful piece of art about life and relationships, and something I think will really enrich your life right now in this really difficult, uncertain time.
And it was particularly special for Tilly because obviously she was based in Dublin.
And loads of it is filmed in Dublin. So it was really nice to see them. Like, a lot of scenes and places the scenes were shot, I recognised, and it really, really took me back.
She kept recognising pubs and bars as well and things like that. And
yeah. Just go watch it. It's amazing. And it was also nice because the male lead actor who plays Connell, called Paul Mescal, went to the Lear, which is where I studied on my foundation year that I just finished.
And I think there were about 9 graduates of the Lear in the show.
Yeah, 9 graduates. It's amazing.
And then my piece of positive news is that we went for a really lovely long walk on Wimbledon Common yesterday in the sun, and it just was a real feel-good activity. And I would recommend anyone, as soon as they can, go to Wimbledon Common. It's amazingly big and it has so much different kind of terrain. Like, there's woodland, there's lakes, there's lots of green open space, loads of trees. It's just gorgeous. Lots of wildlife, birds.
It's a nice escape, actually.
Yeah, and usually there's a really nice cafe, but unfortunately that's shut at the moment. But we look forward to that all opening up.
Exactly. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We hope you found it useful and insightful and gave you a bit of a better understanding of what's going on right now.
Any questions that you have, please do send them to us. We will endeavour to answer them, or ask experts who are able to answer them if we don't know ourselves. It's questions@coronacast.co.uk.
Or you can find us on Instagram and Twitter, and our name is @TheCoronaCast.
And thank you to everybody for your support so far.
Thank you so much. Have a good week.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.